So this is actually a presentation I had. If the Portuguese isn't exactly the same, if it's the Brazilian Portuguese, then I apologize. But essentially, what this deck kind of presents up is I've got the English and then some Portuguese subtitles on some of the slides. But the idea here is, first, as kind of an example, one of the mistakes people make is they don't even know why they're deploying SharePoint. Somebody up in the company is thinking, oh, we need to do SharePoint. And then the IT team starts rolling it out, and they don't know why SharePoint's being done, so they don't know how to configure it. And so they're just running through the wizards, just getting things installed. Anyone ever been in that situation? Where, you know, it's like, hey, we need SharePoint. Well, why are we doing it? What are we doing? So that's part of the challenge with any SharePoint deployment is that confusion that comes around, what are we doing? Is it a portal? Are we doing web content management? Is it collaboration? Are we doing BI? And what's interesting is a lot of people, they think it's not a problem. We'll figure it out later. And that's part of the challenge is, well, how are you really going to understand how to do your security and what accounts should be there? Are we going to do my sites? Are we going to do profiles? And especially when you get into SharePoint 2010, it's that challenge of, well, what are we really doing? Because there's all these services. And one of the first questions you get asked is, what of these services are we going to turn on? What are we going to enable? What is our metadata? What is our taxonomy? There's so many questions that it's not just IT will figure it out. That's part of the challenge. So the worst practice is not knowing what you're doing. It's that, hey, we'll just roll it out. We'll figure it out later. And why the two-headed cow? Well, you see, what happens is one department's going one direction, and another department's going in a completely opposite direction. And in a lot of cases with SharePoint, it can do both of these things, but now you're splitting the environment in terms of, well, is it a secure portal, or is it an open collaboration platform, or is it anonymous blogs? There's some completely different ways of deploying it, and it can create quite the beast. So when talking about these things, in English we call it the KISS principle.
We know.
Yes, that's good. Keep it simple, stupid. And they were like, oh, that's a little bit too harsh in Portuguese. We say, mentana o estupidamente simples. We twist it around a little bit so we don't want to offend anybody. But it's this idea, if we can keep it simple, then we can keep a handle on it. And with SharePoint deployments, a lot of what can happen is it gets very complex very quickly. And oh, by the way, the budget was designed for the first thing they came up with. It wasn't designed for what it's turned into. So it very quickly becomes, we didn't hire enough people, it's too complex, and now it's really hard. Hey, how come SharePoint sucks all of a sudden? It was so great before. That's what we want to avoid. We want to make sure that we're setting it up and managing expectations appropriately. And a lot of that is in terms of how can we keep things simple. And it's not, well, we can't ever do BI on our SharePoint platform. In fact, that ought to be part of your roadmap. Building a SharePoint roadmap is really what's going to help you achieve the goals that your business is going to come up with. Since SharePoint is this kind of large platform that can do all these amazing things, I'm not saying, well, you should lower your expectations, you shouldn't do those things. Really what I'm saying is you need to come up with a roadmap. That's why we have project managers. It's come up with the milestones. Okay, first we want to build a portal. And part of that portal, we want to have some dashboards. We're going to do some line of business integration. But oh, by the way, we need to learn what's in the box. What does SharePoint even do itself before we say, okay, developers, here's all the requirements. Well, most of those requirements you can do with out-of-the-box functionality. how can we actually get the developers working on stuff that's not already in the box? A very common problem in SharePoint is people reinventing the wheel, building things that have already been built, building things that are already in the platform itself. And that kind of transitions into this thing where you take any developer off the street who's never used SharePoint before, and what's the first thing they want to do? Well, they want to change it. They want to build something. And they're not used to working with features and solutions. They're used to building .NET code and assemblies. And from essentially in a SharePoint perspective, you want to avoid building these site definitions, but the first thing they read on MSDN is, how do I build a custom site definition? Exactly. It's these, how do I create a web part? Oh, web parts are SharePoint customization. And really, a lot of what you should be doing as a developer is actually learning what is in the box, what are the features, how do I work with SharePoint rather than against it. And I think that's part of the frustrating thing for SharePoint developers or developers that are new to SharePoint is there's so much here. And oh man, there's not enough documentation on what I'm looking for. You know, there's the SDK, but it only tells you how to use the object. It doesn't tell you what you can do with it. And I think that's where we've got to get creative. And why it's so important in SharePoint to be part of a community, because there are resources that are out there. There's amazing bloggers. There's an incredible community on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and so on. There's all these, the MSDN forums. Lots of places for information. But if you're new to SharePoint, it's how do I, you get frustrated. Man, SharePoint sucks because I can't get it to do these things. It's too hard to brand, you know. It's too hard to make it do what I want it to. Well, if you're part of the community, you'd see, well, there's minimal master pages, and there's these starter master pages on CodePlex. And there's a community around tackling these issues. And that's what's so great about this user group that we're part of here is someone else feels your pain. It's just a matter of finding that person. And when you overcome that challenge, now you've accomplished something great. And now you know something and you can help other people. That's what's great about the SharePoint community and why it's so strong is actually because we all struggle together. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing. You can make some really good money in SharePoint if you haven't realized that. Now, one of the early vision things in SharePoint is helping you realize that there's really two worlds. There's this movement to the cloud and using SharePoint as a commodity application for collaboration or for websites and things like that. There's this other world of more the deep integration with line of business applications. SharePoint does both of these well. It is a platform, and it also is an application that you can use right out of the box. So what's interesting is when the business, you know, your deployment, you're trying to decide, okay, we're deploying SharePoint. Well, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to get a scale-hosted collaboration engine that just provisions site after site after site for projects and team sites and so on for sharing files? Or is it a portal that is, you know, a few authors that publish content and you have a few dashboards and things like that? Or is it an application? It's your interface to SAP. It's your CRM application or some ERP application that's integrating with Salesforce or integrating with SAP. And you're using things like Link to expose BI information on the fly and building Silverlight applications for multimedia. There's some really amazing things you can build, but it costs more development resources. It's not a bad thing. It's just a matter of planning it appropriately, because what happens is the CIO thinks this is what he wants, but he's been convinced this is what he's going to get. And when he essentially, all these requirements get lined up, but the budget is for SharePoint being, oh, it's a Microsoft product, we'll just install it and it'll do its thing. You understand, there's two different worlds here, and it's a matter of setting expectations appropriately. A successful deployment is one where the expectations are set as we move along this roadmap, as we add additional functionality, as we ramp up our development teams, as we get people trained, we're essentially setting the proper expectations. Now, one of the unique things, and I don't know how unique this is, but one of the things with SharePoint is, you know, a lot of other applications, it's they're designed for you to go into the database, build your reports off of the databases and so on. In SharePoint world, we say stay out of the database. Stay out of the content database. There's APIs for getting at the data. Especially, you know, IT people who are used to optimizing their databases, they're going to look at the SharePoint content databases and say, oh, I can write some stored procedures to fix some of these things. I can optimize these indexes and get much better performance. I can go in here and add some additional integrity to make it perform better. Well, one of the big challenges, even especially through upgrade, is if you've been customizing your database, your upgrade will fail. So one of the worst things you can do is customizing your database. So stay out of the database. If you need to, for any reason, you need to access your database directly, you need to make a copy of it, you should not be accessing your production database, even read-only. So that's it's somewhat unusual for people who are coming into the SharePoint world, but there are a lot of reasons, not just performance. Now, what's interesting here as well is this idea that, you know, we've been talking about the development world, there's kind of this SharePoint dance. If you can just learn the way that SharePoint moves and move with it, and as a developer, you add additional functionality on top of it and essentially use the tools in the best way, you can get a lot of value out of SharePoint because there's a lot in there. But if you fight it, that's when SharePoint sucks. It's when you're having this battle. Well, when you start moving to this rhythm, essentially what we find is people who say, we don't need a test environment. You know, we don't have a lot of money. SharePoint, it's got its own built-in approval and workflows. Why can't we use that for our developers? It doesn't work like that. Essentially, you really need to have a separate environment. If you're doing any kind of development, you need to have a dev environment. If you're doing, even in the smallest environments, you need to have a place where you can test out service packs. Another area where people say SharePoint sucks is they've installed a service pack for the very first time. Well, guess what? When you install a service pack in SharePoint, not only is it updating the bits on the box, the binaries, but it also has to update the databases. And so as a result, if you're running this in production, you can get locking in the database. And essentially, as well, sometimes it doesn't finish updating the database until it reboots. Or you've got to run the PS config script, the config wizard, after it's been applied. So there's kind of these funky things that happen where if you've tested it once, you know how it behaves. You need to test out service packs separate from production before you then install it in production. It's a common problem. People trying things out, oh, it's a Microsoft product, it'll be really easy. It's easy if you've done it once in another environment. Then you know how it behaves. Service packs aren't like other service packs in other products. There's special steps that need to be followed. Now, I'm kind of talking about, you know, some of these things that some companies are used to operations frameworks with things like Oracle Financials or an SAP environment. But when it comes to a Microsoft environment, they think there's exceptions. They think they don't need to follow those same operation frameworks with change management, for example. Well, here's an example where we have our dev environment, where code is introduced from various developers. Then it gets packaged up. It gets deployed to a test environment where the testers can verify it. But there may be some additional validation or proof of concepts. Sometimes we have staging environments. Staging environments mimic production. It's great for troubleshooting and verifying the process of rolling things out into an environment that mimics production. Some environments, they may exclude this staging environment and push that concept into the test environment. But you can see this idea of we need to roll out our code through these various stages and why it's so important to package your code in WSPs, these solution packages. Especially in 2007, very, very important you package things up. With Visual Studio 2010, now more of the debug on the fly, F5 debug, and you can package things much, much more easily, and you've got more templates. Workflows are much more easily packaged. But in 2007, those of you who are living now in 2007, you really need to package up your code. It's very, very important, especially when it comes to upgrade. You're then tracking down your customizations. Talking about failed deployments, this is a huge area where all these things get scrunched together. People are introducing code directly into production. And it's not being packaged properly. You don't know what features are custom. You don't know what assemblies have been introduced into the environment. And so when you're trying to do an upgrade or database attach upgrade, you can't even mimic your environment. Production is unique now. There is no copy of that environment. There is no package of these are the solutions that have been added to your farm. So it's a lot about how code flows through a multi-stage deployment. And then we've got, well, the data in a lot of environments is actually introduced into production, especially in a collaboration environment. Well, what about web content management where we have an authoring environment with content deployment, for example? So you really need to understand how does code flow and how does content get introduced into the environment? And what are the rules? You know, it's if I need to add a column to a list, is that something that should be packaged as a solution with SharePoint Designer 2010? And that essentially gets introduced into a test environment before it rolls out to production? Or is it something that, no, users can customize their lists and columns and add additional metadata requirements and so on? Well, how do those things get reintroduced into your staging or your test environment? Well, a lot of that is data needs to move its way back. You need to get copies of your content databases on a recurring basis and reintroduce those, essentially making copies or doing backup restore to get those into your test environment or into your dev environment, just as an example. You ever had any challenges with site collections? Site collection sizing. Definitely, it's a challenge. Should we use a site? Should we use a site collection? You know, are we putting all this data in one list? Is it multiple lists? This information architecture is a serious conversation. You know, I've been in conferences where an entire session is on this one topic of site versus site collection. There is no one way. You know, people think one site collection can fit everything. Well, that may be the right strategy, might not be the right strategy, especially when you're talking about multiple departments and collaboration environments. You know, when essentially, I've been in doing some consulting where a company that had 20,000 employees, they rolled out SharePoint with one site collection. After that database hit a terabyte, they were like, maybe this isn't the right way to do it. So they brought in some consultants and said, split out this data. This database is too large. So they jumped through the hoops and created 17 site collections. One of those site collections was 500 gigabytes. 5 months later, they bring the consultants back in and say, that didn't work. We're still having problems. And oh, by the way, when we add a user, we've got, it takes 5 minutes just to render the number of users on the site collection. Well, aren't you using security groups? Oh, no, we don't use security groups in our company. Active Directory is for authentication. We don't use security groups. Okay. And you can see how these problems, you know, just get worse and worse and worse. So they bring in more consultants, different consultants, and say, look in our environment. And they shake their head and they say, why did you do it like this? I say, well, with SharePoint, it seems like if we put all our data in one place, it's easy to do search across it. It's easy to do our navigation. It's easy to do manage users and so on. Well, did anybody tell you that if you split this up a little bit, it's easier to consume? Like this sandwich, you know? If you had that in multiple sandwiches, it's easier to eat. But look how good it is. Look how good it looks. You know? It's that, how can we tame this beast? Well, you got to eat it one bite at a time, right? But the other thing is it doesn't make it better because it's all in one place. Sometimes it's better to break it up a little bit. And from a planning perspective, essentially, if you can say, okay, what are our security boundaries? What are the different groups of people that are going to be consuming this information? Is there some data that everybody needs to consume? And is there some data that needs to be locked down to this department internal only, for example? And as well, when you start talking about quota in this environment, a nightmare. There's only one quota for this entire thing. So who's going to say, you added too many files, you need to delete some? Well, the whole company is in this bucket. There is nobody to say, get those quota notifications and do something about it. So that's the real challenge. Now, in a document management environment, and I bring this up because there's some exceptions. In a document management environment, maybe we do want to have our 100,000 documents or even a couple hundred thousand documents where we can manage our metadata, all the files in the same place. We've built out our metadata structures. We're doing our taxonomy. We've got search across it. But you know what? The data has a lot of things in common. You know, the people who are consuming this data, the people who are adding files, it's highly structured. There's workflow in place. We've got knowledge managers and information architects that are planning the tagging and the structure. But if you're trying to do a little bit of blogs here, a little bit of my sites here, and you're trying to do some content management and some web content management and some team sites and some projects and so on, it's just it becomes a mess. So one way that I've tried to approach this problem is trying to split this up a little bit. Let's look at this problem in different ways. First off, we have our central portal, the central portal of the company, the place where people go to do search. And when you start talking about service applications and things like FAST and optimizing search, that's a great place to put it. Where do I go for search? At Microsoft, it's MSW. You know that you can, if you open up your browser, you can go to MSW and you can search the entire company. You know, on the internet, you can go to Bing and you can get a search across the internet, right? What is the same concept inside of the company? That you can go to one place and search across the data, right? It's okay to have search of these different places, but we don't want to say you have to go to HR to search across the HR data. You have to go to IT web to search across IT data. No, you can go to one place and you can search across all of it. And then you can add additional search only this site or You know, you can run additional rules to narrow down your content. Now, if you do want to just go search IT data, you can just go to the IT portal. But you don't have to. You know, we've got these divisional portals that focus on departmental data. And even with departmental data, there may be internal facing content, and there may be some external facing content. But essentially, this line here helps divide structured versus unstructured. Now, when we talk about this, that two-headed cow, that's part of that struggle. If you've got a highly structured environment, meaning this is where our line of business integration is going, this is where our developers are building all sorts of interesting applications on top of SharePoint, but then there's that other world of, I just need a team site, I just need a project, I need a place to share some files with somebody. This is ad hoc collaboration. People ought to be able to, on the fly, very quickly be able to create a site or a workspace and spin up a project, create a Gantt chart, you know, add some files, add some metadata, add a little calendar, pull up a survey, you know, all these little things that SharePoint does very, very well. You don't want to have to force them through that highly structured, you have to jump through all these various hoops just to get a place where you can share a file with somebody. But in this kind of hierarchy, you get this idea that there is structured, and the structured world needs to have policies, and the unstructured world needs to have policies. And those policies are quite different. You try and bring these all together, and you end up with that sandwich of, we have terabytes of data, and we don't know how to manage it. Because some of the data needs to be wide open, and other parts of the data needs to be locked down. So essentially, it's about understanding how to treat the data in different ways, even though it's all in SharePoint. And hopefully this kind of resonates with you as well. What happens? Oh, you know, we just spent all this money for SharePoint. Well, can't we just dump all of our data in there? And then it's going to solve all of our problems? We've already heard how great it is at search and how great it is at being able to quickly manage security and so forth on top of it. Adding metadata, the managed metadata service, profiles, all these really cool social aspects to SharePoint. Well, what happens when you start dumping file shares into it and dumping public folder data into it and shutting down other systems and saying, you have to use SharePoint, and people just pick up a bunch of junk and they dump it in SharePoint. You know, pick it up off the hard drive because hard drives are getting smaller or whatever. You know, you shouldn't be storing all this in your PST. Pick it up and dump it in SharePoint. And you end up with a mess. Garbage in, garbage out. That's the mantra with SharePoint. You put good data in there, it's amazing the things you can do with good data in lists, whether it's structured data, you know, now in SharePoint 2010, being able to hook up SQL databases and having the web interface in SharePoint, whether it's CRM data or calendar data, it's amazing what you can do with that interface. But, and even with file shares, yes, there is some data, collaborative data, that should go into SharePoint. My experience is it's somewhere between 4 and 6% of data that's on file shares that should be going into SharePoint. There's 90%+ that should not go into SharePoint. There's a lot of junk that's on those file shares. Yeah, it's consuming a lot of hard disk space, but it's cheap, it's dumb. And when you start dumping data in there, guess what it does to your search results? Takes them down the drain, right? It makes them worse. It doesn't make things easier to find. It makes things harder to find because now you've got old conflicts, old duplicates, where now when you're trying to find a file, you're getting the junk instead of the good stuff. Now, there are tools, and actually Quest makes some tools around this area, of analyze the source. If you've got a notes environment or you've got a file share environment, why can't we analyze those data in the source before we move any of the data over into SharePoint? Let's analyze it. Let's find out what kind of content is in there. Is it new content? Is it collaborative data? Are people using it? Is it locked down? Is there any metadata on it? It's really trying to understand the data that you've got before you start dumping it into SharePoint. And a lot of what I found is if you can find the owners of that data and get them to be part of the process, you're going to be much, much better off because they're going to know if it's collaborative data, is it structured data, how should we be structuring this data in SharePoint. Now, I like this picture a lot. First off, because it seems extremely unlikely that you'd have a little group gathered like this. But second of all, people get really excited about the social features in SharePoint. Well, there's the opposite as well. People who say, you're turning SharePoint into Facebook? Why would you turn SharePoint into Facebook? Or turn SharePoint into Twitter? It's going to waste people's time. You know, we don't want the social features that you're adding into SharePoint. We want to make it, you know, this is the company. We don't want people to waste time. First thing I'll tell you is people don't waste time just staring at a my site. It's not that interesting. Now, yes, it's great being able to see somebody's working on a project, but it's not as sexy as somebody being able to say, hey, hanging out with the guys, here's me drinking. You know, that's not going to be on the my site. Don't worry about it that much. It is important to have policies, but as well, people have already been able to add things to their portals and so on. It's not that much different in terms of, well, if we create my sites, are people going to be adding their pictures, their vacation, and so forth on their my sites? So the first thing here is don't be afraid of the social features in SharePoint. They're designed to make it easier to find information. Social tagging, for example, it's people being able to rate content, it's people being able to tag content, and being able to link and bring people closer to the data. In the past, data was very information focused. You needed to understand the information. Now with SharePoint 2010, there's this push to make things more people-focused. And what's interesting with that pivot of making things more people-focused is it brings people closer together, and it makes it much more interesting to consume in terms of, well, I just found a document, and I found this person authored that document. If I can find more of the content that this person made, and find out more about that person, I can be more productive in the project I'm working on because it gives me the context of, you know, this is the person, this is where they went to school, this is their background, here's the projects they're working on. How can I integrate my needs into what they've been working on? Without even having to contact that person, I can look at their activity stream and see what other things they're working on that are going to make my life easier. And ultimately, I can reach out and contact that person, whether it's sending them an instant message and saying, hey, I came across this amazing document. I have a couple questions for you. Do you mind if I, you know, you can see they're out of office. You know, you can see some really cool stuff in terms of how this world comes together. But ultimately, the world is getting closer. It's not a bad thing to be able to understand other employees in the company and knowing a little bit about them and understanding what they're working on. You may have seen the My Site in SharePoint 2010. I'm actually going to give you a quick demo. I'm on the Microsoft network. I'm not going to show MSW. Don't worry. But I'm just going to show you a little bit about what the My Site looks like in 2010. And so just a couple things here. First off, we're looking at, we'll make this nice. Okay. Here we are looking at a SharePoint 2010 My Site. This is the one that Microsoft uses. And first off, we can kind of see you get a little picture. We have a little status. You might think, well, is there a way to aggregate all this status and bring it into some kind of Twitter feed? Out of the box, no. But there are products that are built on top of SharePoint, NewsGator, for example, that helps you bring some of these things together. We've got all these tabs across here. You can populate the Ask Me About, and you can see an activity feed. Now, I haven't touched this in a while, so you can just see basically what I just did. Let me show you as an example. I'm just going to edit my profile. And I can add Ask Me About SharePoint. And look at that. Automatically, it pops up the metadata. There is a keyword, SharePoint. And there's even this whole entire structure of Microsoft products and technology. In fact, I'm going to choose that one as well. Serious managed metadata, huh? So you can see the tags that people have encouraged, as well as the structure that's populated here. I'm just going to populate this real quickly. You can see this is additional information they've added on top of it, is things like past projects, the office location, the time zone, skills. And I like this one here, this schools, the birthday, and so on. And now here at the bottom, you find this section about news feed settings. And you can get notify me when someone adds a note to my profile, notify me when someone adds me as a colleague. Essentially, when they add you as a colleague, that means they're going to be consuming your activity stream. I want to see status message and tagging and note board posts and ratings and so on. I save this information, and now when you click the more information, you get these things. Now, what's interesting is all of these things I've populated are links. So when I click on one of these tags, it automatically does a search for that term, and I can get people who match that term. So, for example, at Microsoft, there's Jeff Teeper, who's the corporate vice president over SharePoint, and we can see, as well, there's Derek Burney, who was the WSS group manager, general manager before, and so on. You get other people that match that. Now, what's interesting is right here, when I'm looking at a person, I can add them as a colleague. I can browse them in the org chart, and so on. I can see documents they've been working on, interesting things like that. So I can, first what I'll do is I'll add them as a colleague, and you can create groups. So you can group colleagues in terms of these are my colleagues that went to the same school, or these are the colleagues who are SharePoint colleagues versus Exchange colleagues. So I can create a new group called SharePoint. And now I've got them in my network. Now, as well, you see all these people. Well, there's about 10,000 results for people who match the term SharePoint. A lot of SharePoint people at Microsoft now, I guess. As well, we can narrow this down by job title. Let me see the product managers in SharePoint. Now we reduce that down to the first 10 of 300. And we can see that we've now reduced it further. And we can see, well, what about people that are actually in the SharePoint organization? Just the product managers who are in SharePoint, not somebody who previously worked in SharePoint. Now we've narrowed it down to 38 results. So we're getting closer. In fact, our first results here is the new general manager, Eric Swift, over the SharePoint organization. He's the one who replaced Tom Rizzo. And so you could see how we're getting closer and closer to finding the right people as we narrow down our results. And we haven't had to do anything with search. We're still looking in the term SharePoint, but we're getting closer and closer. And we can see interests, skiing, basketball, baseball. Skydiving, artistic painting, fishing, and so on. You can see all these different things that they're actually working on. So you can see, well, I need to find a SharePoint product manager who has similar interests. So you can see how you can narrow this down further. And I want to narrow it down to somebody who says, ask me about SharePoint 2010. And that gets me to Richard Riley and 10 results. So now we're looking at, you know, going down this list of SharePoint product managers who work in SharePoint team who have said, ask me about SharePoint 2010. So now I've got this down to the group of people that I'm looking to. And we can click on Richard and we can see, not only that, we can see his organization chart. And have you seen the new organization chart? We've got a nice Silverlight control for being able to quickly see in the organization how people relate. So we can see peers. We can see who reports to Richard. And you can work up the tree as well, right through this nice little Silverlight control. And I can add them as a colleague to the SharePoint group. So let's go back to my colleagues. And now I can see a way to manage my colleagues. People that are on my team, including the group that I just created, which is my SharePoint group. And I can look right at their My Site. And as an example, we're talking about activity feeds. Yesterday, Richard Riley updated his interests where he's now interested in skiing, water skiing, hiking, the SharePoint product team. And he even updated his Ask Me About to SharePoint 2010. And I can even post on his My Site. Cool stuff. Any questions here? Cool. Yeah, on the My Site, it's interesting. We can now jump back to the presentation. I don't want people to underestimate or overestimate what you can do. But one of the important things I think in SharePoint 2010 is profiles. You know, if you've been holding off on doing my sites because you're worried about it getting too much data for people and lots of sites, you can still do profiles. Profiles are very important for the managed metadata service and for tagging. So if you're when you're planning out your SharePoint 2010 environment, definitely plan on profiles. And profiles themselves have gotten so much richer as a result of not just being able to pull in Active Directory information, but also being able to pull in other sources of information from CRM applications or HR applications. There's even ways of consuming image data. And the whole managed organizational structure, so much easier now to pull this data from other sources. It's also one of the more difficult areas to set up now with the Forefront Identity Manager, the FIM, but it pays off. I expect this area to get a little bit to get better. Those of you who have been playing with SharePoint 2010, there are a few challenges around the profiles, but it does pay off in the long run. One of the things you'll find with SharePoint is you're the guy. They throw you in the fire, and we need somebody to do it, and so they load up your plate. You know, lots and lots of data coming at you. And essentially, without even realizing, now you're the one-man band. You're doing development, you're doing the infrastructure, you're doing projects, and you're getting overloaded with information. So a lot of it is juggling, essentially. But what I'm saying is there are ways of better managing this. And one of the ways to manage this is actually with a user group. Now you think, user group? I'm a member of the user group. What are you saying? I'm saying inside of your company, you should plan on building a user group inside of your company. Anybody in here have user groups inside their company? All right, some guys over here. Good job.
Same company.
How about that? Yeah. But the idea here is it brings together a forum of people so that you can share ideas together. It allows you as a group to then find out who the experts are, share of what projects are going on, what people are finding that works well, getting presentations on, well, when are we doing the upgrade? And what features are we going to turn on? What are the service applications we're going to use? When you start talking about who's doing what, a RACI chart, and RACI is responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed. If you're ever looking for more money for the project you're working on, this is a great way to show, look, this one guy is doing everything. He's also doing the dev, and he's doing the test, and he's doing production. Do you see anything wrong with this? So it's a great way of exposing who is responsible for security, how is change management working. Now we can actually start to reveal why are we having problems in our environment. It's not just because SharePoint sucks. In fact, it doesn't suck. It's an amazing platform. It's incredible the things you can do with it. It has a lot more to do with we haven't planned it appropriately, we haven't staffed it appropriately, we don't have a plan, we don't have a vision, and that's why things are failing. Now, one little tip in SharePoint 2010 is this thing called sandbox solutions. Sandbox solutions are one of the coolest new things for developers. Why is it cool? Because you don't even have to talk to the IT administrators. The idea is, you can build user solutions that use the client object model and directly add those solutions into the SharePoint environment. Wild stuff. Now, what's cool for the IT administrators is they can set them up into being a sandbox. The idea with the sandbox is you can control how many resources these projects, these solutions, these user solutions can consume. So the idea here is we want to allow people to do projects, you know, be able to build solutions like navigation We don't want to have to test your navigation or your design in some cases. We want to just be able to say, you can consume this much memory. If you have problems, then we're going to put you through the path of going through dev, test, staging, production. But we found a way to limit the amount of memory. Yes, there's no server-side code. We're talking about solutions that take advantage of an API that's a published API. And the idea is it's in a sandbox. Limited amount of resources those solutions can consume. Now, one of the last things here is really one of the most important. In SharePoint 2010, there's a lot of buttons and switches. There's a lot of knobs. When you do your initial install into SharePoint 2010, it asks you, what do you want to do? What of all these services do you want to provision? There's a lot of checkboxes. Let's just turn it all on and see what happens, right? That's the bad practice. Look at all these services here, you know. The business data connectivity, the managed metadata, search, secure store, state, health, profiles. There's like 50 things. There's a ton of them. What do you want to turn on? What are you going to use? It's much harder to turn things off than it is to turn them on. It's very easy to turn on. It's very difficult to turn off. So the idea here is, how do we know what we should be provisioning and what we shouldn't be provisioning? And not only that, when you start talking about keep it simple, the opposite of keep it simple is you've turned it all on. Now you've got to figure out what are the relationships between the different web applications in terms of what services are enabled on which services. And the idea here as well is farms have relationships. All these a la carte services have now been enabled where you can consume managed metadata not only across a single farm, but across multiple SharePoint farms. Databases. There's a ton of databases in SharePoint 2010. Get used to that idea. Every service has at least one database. And as an example, you turn on profiles, you have three databases. Profiles, profile synchronization, and social tagging. So there's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. Talking about services, this is a good reference slide. There are some services that are local only, like Access and Visio and Excel Services and Performance Point. There's other services that can be consumed globally, like search and profiles and managed metadata. It's a little bit hard to read, but one of the things that I think will help people get started and that's kind of missing from the documentation right now is, what are the services that I should get started with, and what are the ones that I should then tack on later? I kind of look at these as infrastructure, things like the state service, web analytics, business connectivity, and the foundation setting service. You should just simply turn these on. Then we move into some of the optional ones that are kind of a good start as well. Managed metadata, which includes the profiles, the profile sync, and social tagging. My Sites is optional. Don't think you have to have My Sites and profiles. As well, we need to get some search, whether you're using FAST or whether you're using the SharePoint server search. Then we move into kind of this medium stage. Well, now these are definitely choices. Office web apps. Do we want to enable the client services on the web? The office web apps like Word, PowerPoint, OneNote, Excel, and so on. Visio. Maybe you don't start with Visio, the Visio graphics service. Performance Point. It's part of the enterprise piece. Do we want to enable it? Do we want to wait? Single sign-on, obviously that relates in some cases as well. Then we move into the kind of the more advanced services, and even Performance Point might fall into this as well, but you start talking about things like Access, Project Server, Analysis Services. I really think people should not start in this world, right? The idea is you really need to understand what's in the box, build up that foundation, and in some cases, I really like the idea of running project in a separate farm than my collaboration environment. Now, project itself is built on the enterprise license. So if you don't want everybody consuming that enterprise license, it is actually a much better idea to be keeping it separate. Now, you can set up a web application that is more restrictive, that does just have this service, but from a farm perspective, now you're trying to manage these services and the CPU it contains and trying to separate some services, you know, over here versus over there. It can get quite complex in this world. And even access itself requires reporting services, just as an example. And this is the last thing. And I could have spent, you know, the whole session, in fact, even at the Best Practices Conference, I spent a whole day just on upgrade. But one of the most important things around upgrade is don't just play clueless. Don't just run setup and see what happens. The idea with upgrade is really you need to do the homework. The better you understand upgrade, the better you're going to do on it. One of the key things is testing. They've really made it much more simple in terms of upgrade. There's two choices, in-place upgrade and database attach. Well, while there's two methods, there's actually ways of combining both of those upgrades in terms of being able to do a hybrid upgrade. Now, what's interesting is the default upgrade is the in-place upgrade. The slowest database attach faster because you can do multiple databases at the same time. As likely to fail is in place. Because, and the other thing is, which one gives you higher uptime? Well, you don't get any uptime in place. So my high recommendation is you do testing. As well, you do the research. Validate both of these different types of upgrade with your environment. A couple of just quick points. A couple of the Quest products have been upgraded. There's Recovery Manager, which makes it much easier to recover out of your environment that now supports SharePoint 2010. The Migration Manager, which now supports 2003 to 2010 and 2007 to 2010, and even 2007 to 2007, talking about splitting site collections and moving data around. And I wish I had these books here with me, but I have finished this SharePoint 2010 Upgrading and Migrating Best Practices book, but it's on the web. It's not yet in print, unfortunately. And obrigado. Thank you.
Now would be the time to make the questions.
Yes. He wants you to use the microphone.
Hi. When you talk about my sites, I had a work with my sites in 2007, and one of the fights that I have with SharePoint, it's branding. Mm. I don't test yet in 2010. Is this best or not?
It does get a little bit better. No, it's not fixed.
Okay.
But one of the things is if you have branded your 2007 sites, you're going to lose it.
Yeah.
Essentially, SharePoint 2010 upgrade automatically upgrades the look and feel to 2010. So it's one of the things where in upgrade in your other sites, you can have a kind of a preview mode where you, by default, you can see 2007 look and feel, and then you can apply the 2010 and see if you want it or not. But when you do a 2010 upgrade with my sites, it automatically upgrades them.
Yeah.
You lose your branding.
But if I want to do a new branding in my sites, is this better in 2010? It's easier?
It is a little bit easier.
To brand?
A little bit.
Yeah, okay. I see.
It's not.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyone else? podem fazer questões, ok?
Well, I have a question.
Sure. Yeah.
With the evolution of the product with SharePoint from 2001 up to now, into 2010, we have been witnessing that the product is gaining adoption, it's gaining features, it's gaining functionality.
Yeah.
One of the most maybe exciting new ways is that, I don't know if everybody knows this, but now the project server is a service on SharePoint 2010.
Yeah.
So how do you see the roadmap into the future of this platform that, for what it looks, it won't stop in 2010 version, of course.
That's right. So the question is around the roadmap. And I think what's interesting is when you start looking around even at the Microsoft products, and we see kind of this convergence. Just look at Performance Point. Look at Project. Look at this Dynamics world. I think they're just waiting for the SharePoint platform to mature to a level where SharePoint is the interface for the back office. I'm not saying it's your email client, but if you look at even at OWA, you can actually see that it says Office Web Application, right? It actually fits into that bucket of, man, it looks a lot like the Office Web Applications that SharePoint runs. I'm not saying that Exchange is going to SharePoint. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I don't think that's part of the roadmap. But I do think that what you see with Project and Performance Point and those as an example, the Access Services, Excel, Visio, all these interesting servers now that line up with being on top of SharePoint, there's a lot of job security there, let me tell you. people who work in SharePoint, there's so much to learn. There's so much to become specialized in. There's so much for all of us, and even more. You know, people say, well, it's going to become a commodity. Well, no, it's not, because it's only going to continue to expand as a platform and add additional services on top of it. As an example, I'm running a conference in Germany next week, and I have about 20 speakers. I sent out a message to those speakers and said, can any of you guys do a session on Performance Point? Gethsemane said, yes. None of those guys could. I mean, these are SharePoint experts. That's the challenge, right? It's like there's so much here. If I want a Performance Point expert, I've got to go and find a Performance Point expert. Now, that's a challenge in and of itself as well, is because it's so big, oh, well, my SharePoint consultant, he should also be able to do Project Server. Not necessarily. You can probably find a Project Server expert who can also do SharePoint, but probably not the other way around. It's interesting. It becomes kind of a dilemma in some cases, but when you're talking about in the past where it was completely separate, where you'd have a project person, a SharePoint person, a Performance Point person, they would be completely separate, you know, BI and CMS and so on. But now this whole world of converging of SharePoint as a platform and we add these services on top of it, the roadmap looks bright in terms of, not only Microsoft products, but other third parties can build entire platforms on top of it, business productivity management solutions on top of SharePoint. I think it just becomes richer and richer. Just one kind of example is in the legal field in the U.S., I've heard of people who are deploying SharePoint because their vendor built their product on top of SharePoint. So they were introduced to SharePoint because their product they were using was built on SharePoint. So it's interesting how people arrive now at SharePoint and how vendor solutions are driving them into SharePoint. Yeah.
I got a question to Joe. What's the coolest feature in SharePoint for you? Or Joe Olson? The coolest one?
That's always a tough one. I think the PowerShell for IT people like myself, is something that was a very, very important and critical thing coming into SharePoint 2010. Now, essentially, you can script the deployment end-to-end, an entire infrastructure, multiple servers and multiple farms, just by running a PowerShell script. I think that makes our lives much, much easier. And when it comes to fixing things, we can share scripts with each other. Now, where in the past we would get stuck and say, oh, you'd have to touch the database to fix that, now we have access to the object model. I think that's huge in terms of what we can do.
Just one more.
No problem.
Yeah. Eu acho que o pessoal aqui em Portugal tem um bocado de vergonha de fazer perguntas. Pelo menos aquilo que eu vejo é que muito...
Tá ligado.
Muito poucas perguntas se fazem quando as pessoas têm muitas coisas que querem saber. Agora vamos mudar para inglês. Joe.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Obrigado.
I was complaining that nobody is asking questions. The thing is, talking about upgrades, I see two main options, which is the first one is in-place upgrade, when you upgrade your existing infrastructure, or a second one, when you deploy a different farm and then you upgrade the databases or you upgrade your data on a web application basis.
Yeah.
What is your view on these two options? Why would one choose the first or the second one?
That's a good question. Both of the methods have pros and cons. The in-place, the pros are around being able to keep your existing configuration and to upgrade the services in the easiest way. With the database attach, it's the fastest, it's the cleanest. It's cleanest because you can set up your brand new SharePoint 2010 farm and grab your databases, your content databases, and attach them. So it can be easy from that perspective of attaching content. It can be problematic in terms of, well, did you have all the dependencies and so on? So essentially, the service applications, upgrading your profiles, for example, is quite difficult in a database attach. If your service applications is something that you're okay with rebuilding in 2010, database attach is going to be much, much easier for you in SharePoint 2010. In-place upgrade can be problematic because essentially you'd have to take it all down when you're doing your setup approach. Now, what I like actually is the best of both worlds. And this is what I encourage people to do. And obviously, in all these cases, you have to test it. But the idea here is make a copy of your 2007 environment. That's the first thing you do. So from the base all the way up, all your customizations and so on, you make an exact copy. Okay? Then detach the content databases, then run an in-place, and on your source, set it all read-only for the things you're upgrading. Okay, so you've detached all your databases. Now upgrade will be very fast because all you're upgrading is the configuration databases and the services on this other farm. When upgrade completes, then you attach those databases. Does that make sense? So then you upgrade your data at the second part of it, and you can do multiple database attach, which makes it much faster. So then you're running SharePoint 2010 on that second farm. You had run in place to upgrade your services and your configuration. So you've been able to keep your configuration database and all the solutions that were in that configuration database. And your databases were upgraded faster because you used content database attach, multi-stream, and so on. And we had our source in a separate environment where we had read-only access to that separate farm.
Just a comment.
Yeah.
This is only possible if you have 2007 and 64 bits.
Speak to the microphone. Because
I was just commenting that is only possible if you have 2007 in 64 bits and not in 32, because you can't upgrade.
So essentially what I was just explaining in this example is we have our source our source can be whatever. It has to be at least Service Pack 2 of SharePoint 2007. When we make a copy, your copy, don't make a 32-bit. Make that one 64-bit. It can still be 2007, but it has to be Windows Server 2008, and so on. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. So when you make that copy, make sure it's got all the prerequisites. Yes.
Mais questões? More questions?
That was a good question, yeah.
Can I make another one? It's about virtualization. What do you think about deploying SharePoint 2010 on a virtual environment?
So I've seen...
You have 14 minutes to finish.
That's all right. That's fine. Yeah, postpone 10 minutes. Yeah. In a virtual environment, SharePoint 2010 is definitely possible. In fact, virtualization is becoming quite common. I would say it's somewhere around 50 to 60% in terms of even in production environments where people are now using virtualization. There are some common as well. People are making some mistakes with virtualization in SharePoint 2010. First off, when you read the minimum requirements and it says 8 gigs of RAM, it's serious. It sounds kind of crazy that that would be a minimum for a product, but what's interesting with SharePoint 2010 is at 4 gigs of RAM, SharePoint 2007 is actually much faster than 2010. When you go to 8 gigs of RAM, because SharePoint 2010 is designed for 64-bit, SharePoint 2010 is faster than 2007. So there's something that happens there where, especially when you start talking about service applications, really depending on what service apps you use, performance really gets drastically different. You add Project Server, you add Access Services, and man, CPU just goes way up. That's why I say hold off. You know, if you're trying to do build a collaboration environment, build a portal, do some BI dashboards or whatever, you can still do all those amazing things, but just kind of make milestones, understand how do we get our upgrade and then be steady state with what we had before and then layer on the services afterward. But going back to the virtualization part of it, write through disks, very important. A lot of what people are doing is they'll put it in some common virtual environment with other applications, and they'll starve the SharePoint environment. You know, it's in a shared environment where the disks may not be optimized for write-through performance. SharePoint 2010 is much more write-intense than it was in the previous version, in 2007. There's much more going on in terms of the service applications, in terms of how much CPU and memory they use. I've heard crazy things around app pools. I've heard of people having a 32-gigabyte application pool. I mean, it's wild. In fact, somebody was saying, our application pools in SharePoint 2010, just starting it, are 6 gigabytes. And they're like, okay with that. So we're talking about some more high-performance things that people are doing, but it's essentially, don't starve SharePoint 2010. It loves memory. It's not uncommon for people to be using 16 gigs, 32 gigs on their web front ends, and even SQL. Essentially, you look at, yes, you can have double the performance, but you got to double the amount of memory and CPU you were using before. Cores, you notice in the minimum requirements, it now requires 4 cores. The more cores you give it, the better performance you're going to get out of it. Performance is actually something where it takes advantage of it. You give it the performance, it'll take it. Yeah.
Mais questões? No?
Yeah.
Well,
good questions, yeah.
I would pick up the subject on the comments on the 64K a bit, because many implementations are nowadays in 2007 in 32-bit. For who's planning to go to 2010, should they first step up to 2007 64-bit as a milestone, or should they go radical and just went wild to 2010, if possible?
That's a great question. So some people who you're existing, you're running 32-bit, you're doing fine in your environment. When you run, there's a tool called the pre-upgrade check. If you run the pre-upgrade check on that environment, you're going to get a big bar that says, not ready. You're not running 64-bit Windows Server 2008. My suggestion there is, are you going to be buying new hardware? If you're going to be buying a new farm or, you know, provisioning from a virtual perspective, new images, then I actually am less concerned about it. You need to be running Service Pack 2 of 2007. But really, your 2010 environment, go wild in terms of let's build out the right 2010 environment, and then it's more of a database attach into that 2010 environment. You worry about the service applications. There are PowerShell scripts to upgrade search. There are PowerShell scripts to upgrade the profiles even, where you can mount them in once you've provisioned the managed metadata store and the profile service in your 2010 environment. So you can get that data across. As well, if you take a copy of that environment, you upgrade that, you can use backup restore to backup and restore the service apps as well.
Another main issue would be custom code, custom development, mm-hmm. because if the whatever development is made is not prepared for 64-bit, it can be an issue, right?
Well, what's interesting is the prepared for 64-bit, a lot of it has to do with did the developer hard code the paths, or were the solutions essentially, will they go to the new path when you install them on that 2010 environment? A lot of solutions, you just open it up with Visual Studio 2010 and essentially recompile it when you then play it and build the package with Visual Studio 2010. It's almost that easy, just opening it up and then resaving it. There are some additional steps, but now your solutions are 2010 compatible. So I think it's a necessary exercise sometimes around your solutions. Some solutions, you don't even have to do anything to them. They're already designed for much more of a kind of a dynamic path. With SharePoint, is it 64-bit, is it 32-bit? Well, the developer shouldn't have put in hard-coded paths to that Hive or to that program files and so on.
I got a question regarding developing. I know a lot of people that are starting developing in SharePoint 2010, and they are using Windows 7 as base for development. What do you think about it?
I think this is a good debate. It's a good question. On Twitter, we had some really good conversations early on around who's going to use Windows 7 64-bit and then build native. Who's going to go with virtualization for their dev environments and build in a, you know, maybe use a, what do you call them? Those virtual disks, but essentially, you know, booting from a VHD or dual boot to Windows Server 2010. What I found is the debate continues. It's like 30%, 30%, 30%. People are not just using Windows 7 and building on that. In fact, I think that's actually becoming less and less and less. Those who in the beginning were building that way
I was questioning this because I know for a fact that some kind of services don't work very well on Windows 7.
That's true.
And the guys here in Portugal, the main industry, tend to let's go to the economical way. Let's buy a portable with 4 gigs of RAM. Windows 7, it works. Okay. The our premises as as a developers, you have to have the development environment the same or similar to the production. We don't put Windows 7 on production, right?
Yeah, not okay. no Windows 7 production.
The problem is as this kind of, I think Microsoft when exposed this kind of development on SharePoint 2010 tend to lead to academic side of it, and the corporated clients are intending to use that as a development production environment, you know.
It's a great conversation. I think one of it's a great push for TechNet and MSDN subscriptions. Because, you know, when you get multiple client access licenses to a common SharePoint 2010 server 2008 environment, it's going to pay off in the long run, because it does more closely mimic production.
Okay.
Just choose the a little bit more time.
An hour?
That hour is.
Mais yeah. Questões? Tem mais questões ou não?
Hi, I have a question regarding the software for use for the database. Is there any practical difference between the SQL from Microsoft 2008 standard to the enterprise regarding performance in SharePoint?
That's a good question. There are engine optimizations that are in the enterprise edition, but performance overall, it's not the performance necessarily that's the reason to upgrade between standard and enterprise. The reason to go to enterprise is things like you care about uptime, you care about, you know, are you going to use, what's it called, database mirroring, for example?
Snapshots.
Yeah, there's kind of a list of things you get when you move into enterprise, but mostly it's features. It's not necessarily performance. You know, you test standard against enterprise, you shouldn't even notice that much of a difference. You know, it's more of applying the license, you know, and getting lighting up features. There is good information on Microsoft.com around what are those features.
Thanks.
Yep. Unless you've got a ton of processors, you're not going to know.
Mais questões? Pode perguntar? Temos mais questões ou não? Não?
I have a question. I don't understand very much about SQL Server. So if you have a farm that has Microsoft SQL Server with clustering,
yep.
Do you need the database mirroring? Should you use it, or what's the...
Clustering versus database mirroring.
Yeah.
Good question. The first question around you're trying to design a SharePoint 2010 environment, and you've been running clustering in your environment. Is it okay to continue to using clustering? Clustering will give you fault tolerance on the hardware. So for essentially, if you have one of your servers that goes down, the disks fail over and they're attached to the other node. Well, what happens when there's a flood? That data center is now unavailable. Or what other kind of disasters do you have here? you know, is it volcanoes or hurricanes or... things like that, right? If that location is gone, where is the other location? What mirroring will give you is it's going to get you data outside of that location to another location. You can do mirroring within the data center, or you can do mirroring to another location. And there's actually a couple of types of mirroring. But database mirroring is going to give you, and what's interesting in SharePoint 2010 is SharePoint 2010 is mirroring aware. In 2007, it didn't know about mirroring, so it was a manual process of, great, now my data's over here, now I need to update my configuration database to point to the databases over here. You have to, so it was kind of a pain. In 2010, if you've got a SQL witness and you've got your mirror, SharePoint will know now that its databases are over here, including the configuration database. So you can actually mirror these databases. Essentially giving you that fault tolerance, not of just the hardware, but fault tolerance of that entire data center. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So if you don't have the physical possibility to have a server outside, you don't use mirroring. And you, if you already have the...
If you have one data center,
yeah,
it might not make sense.
Okay, and I have another question. It's the
unless it's a big data center and you want to have fault tolerance from this side of the data center and that other side of the data center. Yeah.
If you would like to have a farm distributed in two geographic separated cities,
Yep. How
could you do it? If you wanted to have servers, application servers and front ends and SQL in both geographical separated locations, could you keep it synchronized? How would you do it?
Okay. So the first thing in SharePoint 2010, did we get any new replication? No, there's no replication in SharePoint 2010. Okay, that's the first thing. There is no replication. But we do have mirroring. So essentially, if you're okay with active-passive, where you can mirror from location A to location B, you can mirror and then essentially have it come up, but it would be active-passive. If you're looking for active multi-replication, you're talking about a third-party product.
Okay.
Yeah. And there are products that do that, not in the box. Not a SQL product, not SQL replication. Not okay. Good question.
No? I have another one.
This is my last question, I promise. It's regarding the configuration wizard. You mentioned about PowerShell, Windows PowerShell. Would you use the configuration wizard to deploy a production environment or only for testing and development? I mean, creating all the service applications and databases and all that stuff. Would you still use this or would you prefer a different approach like scripting?
Okay. So that's a really good question. And you can tell he really knows SharePoint 2010 to ask that question. But the first thing is there is this configuration wizard. And in 2007, we had to use the configuration wizard a lot. Now in SharePoint 2010, with PowerShell and the ability to script, there are companies that are going with this idea of we never have to run the psconfig wizard because we script everything. Anything we deploy to our deployment should be scriptable. So that if there's a disaster, we click once and we can rebuild our environment on the fly. There's some amazing things that people are now doing with scripting and PowerShell. But what you'll find is with service packs and hotfixes, we're back to you install the hotfix and you rerun the wizard. Now, the exception to that is people who are using the multi-tenant environments where they basically are forced to run scripts. But I do think that there are people who are like, automation is the key. So I think that you'll find there's some environments where they're just trying to fully automate everything, including slipstreaming hotfixes. So what they'll do in their environments is they're going to go to their disaster recovery scripts and they'll add the package into the slipstream. So essentially, when you're going to redeploy, it's automatically slipstreamed into the SharePoint 2010 environment. But with your existing production environment, you're going through your normal provisioning of just running your, installing your service pack, updating the databases. But what's one of the new patching solutions in SharePoint 2010 is that ability to essentially first apply the patch to the binaries. And you can do that without even rebooting. You basically install it with your databases set to read-only. Then when you have your downtime, you can then apply it to the databases. So you can do this kind of staggered approach to applying your service packs. But the PS running the wizard, I would say that there's no necessarily defined best practice yet around whether you have to or should or shouldn't. But I do think that people that are scripting it out will just simply add it to part of the slipstream for any hotfix or service pack.